Good morning, guys, from a very sunny studio here in both Germany and London. Well, we started this episode with shades on because me and Martin had a really cool time with XYZ on Wednesday, and we thought we would try and somehow replicate their helmets with our own sunshades. So here we go. We may take them off after the intro. So anyway, good morning, guys. How are you all?
Good morning. And then I'm a bit disappointed I was not invited to the XYZ demo. So all I have is like these glasses.
Next one, Patrick, we'll
We'll
get you
get
there.
you in the
Yeah, it's a funky place. Okay. All right. So today, guys, we're going to talk about one of Europe's hottest startups based in Germany, Superstar Team. We focus on retrofitting, which is obviously a very hot topic right now. And what's interesting, and what we'll also discuss today, is the funding round that we will discuss is not yet announced. So with
I can make a
Mr.
joke. Retrofitting is actually a cold topic. That's why it's retrofitting. So to make it more hotter.
Or in Greg from AO's case on Tuesday, a windy topic. So with Patrick himself, we will also explore in this episode why you should not pay too much attention to the PR of funding rounds. Welcome to Bricks and Bytes broadcast with Patrick Hellerman, a weekly digest of the hottest construed tech news. But before we get started, the icebreaker question, Patrick. What is the worst type of pitch that you come across?
So morning, guys. The worst type of pitch. So I actually get to enjoy when pitches are quite varied and different. So there's like many pitches that can appeal to me in their own right. But you're right. There's like one type of pitch that really just bugs me. And that is when founders come with a sense of entitlement. They try to rush you. They try to even every year you have a few founders that try to exert authority by being aggressive, by being, what's the word? Like overly,
Imposing.
yeah, imposing. That's a great word, Martin. Thanks. And for example, one of my younger colleagues a few weeks back had a pitch where a founder basically broke off the pitch after 5 minutes because he said, "Look, I mean, you guys didn't invest the time last time. Now I see that you're only an associate, so let's break it off, and you can come back to me when you
Wow,
have
that's
more
meaningless.
senior people on the call."
Do you
How
think
do you
it's
think this is going to build a relationship? It's a very stupid way of doing it.
That
Do
sucks.
you think that in between founders who do these things, that they kind of, is it like a concept to approach VCs with such an arrogance sometimes?
I don't think that's a concept. I think it's a lack of maturity, and it's a
Yeah.
lack of second, third order type thinking, because unfortunately, I'm very well connected in our community and especially in that country. And I'm pretty sure that whenever someone else asks me my opinion of the company, I'll also have to share that anecdote.
This one needs to go in the Practical Nerds horror war stories. We're looking forward to hearing more of those.
Actually, that's one of our best performing episodes on Practical Nerd. So we'll give it an update.
Yeah, super exciting. Okay, retrofitting. So, Martin, do you wanna spill the beans on a retrofitting?
Yeah, so the retrofitting seems like an interesting subject from this point of view that at least in Europe, UK, we have such an old housing stock. And with the 2050 targets and all of the stuff that the European Union is pushing and UK government is pushing, there will be a need, more and more need to retrofit the existing housing stock. So this is kind of exciting and shows an opportunity in the space. There are some statistics, like in Germany, 24 million houses need upgrading. In UK, I think it is around 30 million. So the numbers are huge, and is there anyone doing anything to get that done? Obviously, it cannot be done manually without tech, I think. So what do you guys think?
For me, I mean, you definitely notice that a number of startups emerging in this space. So obviously, we're going to be discussing Enter today a little bit, and what those guys are doing over in Germany and their plans to scale Europe and become pan-European. But also over in the UK, Patrick, you mentioned one earlier, FirmNow, which I've actually personally come across before. So I think people are tackling it. I think there's opportunity, like the government obviously subsidizing some of the installations that you can retrofit your house with, i.e. air source heat pumps, and probably some others, but I'm not 100% aware of. And the subsidy and the grants that we call them here is a whole kind of debated topic in itself. But just from personal experience, still way more expensive to install an SLC pump. In fact, installing on some of the projects we do, we've built, installing, just finished installing one, and we have one another project where one will be going in. And I think it's, I'm still a little bit skeptical, but
Of the retrofitting in general, or in
cost.
In terms of cost.
People are still very reluctant when they see how much it costs for like the initial upfront expenditure, and also you have to upgrade your house with different plumbing work and also like insulation in the walls. So yeah, still a little, still some way to go, but good to see that people are now tackling it. And yeah, I think it'd be interesting to hear the sort of investors' perspective, Patrick, and how you guys are looking at the retrofit market right now.
So I think you're generally right to be skeptical about the economics of it, because if you look at a building in isolation of, hey, someone's going to live in it, but it's not going to get transacted. So meaning it's not going to be rented out, or it's not going to be sold. The economics just on operating it, of most of the measures that you could do, there are a few that are exceptions here, would, like, you would have 40 years payback time.
Yeah.
But the number one, insulation in the walls, windows, they typically have way shorter payback times, oftentimes sub 10 years. So they are very effective measures that you can do, but you need to know about, and you need to fit them to the physical substance of your building. I'll come back to the physical substance. So I think that's one of the triggers where the economics then all of a sudden makes sense. And the other one is when, once you start transacting it, because they are stranded assets and soon to be stranded assets that are a real problem. So for example, we see around Antwerp that the largest broker firms of the country partner with Antwerp because they say, hey, all of a sudden the houses and buildings that I can transact become liquid again, because I have done an energy audit on it and I've designed the renovation measures. And the future buyer now sees how this sort of soon to be stranded asset can get 3-4 energy classes better, and then it becomes liquid and can get transacted. So that's the other reason why you can actually make economic value, not necessarily from the operation itself, but from upgrading the value and making it fungible and liquid again, right? So these are the two things. And what I find fascinating here is, so there's been over the years a lot of companies that do very high level portfolio assessment of the CO2 impact or the energy impact of buildings. And I'm not particularly keen on any of those, because I think it's too shallow value propositions. There's not enough differentiation. So we haven't engaged in any of those. But I come from an energy background. I studied energy management 20 years ago. I worked in wind, solar, M&A, and then I worked for one of the largest utilities in the world. So my energy background allowed me to build a slightly different thesis on the energy retrofit space. And in a nutshell, it's the following. When it comes to buildings and its energy footprint, there's three types of data that you can use. The first one is the consumption of the data, meaning how many kilowatt hours per year does the building consume? That's data that the smart meter providers have, or meter providers have. That's what the utilities have. That's what the building owner has. That's what the grid operators have. That's the first level of data. It really isn't particularly intelligent. It doesn't help you design any retrofit measures. It only tells you the building is consuming too much, and everybody has the data. The second type of data is the load curves of the technical equipment, meaning whatever boiler you have in place, whatever heat pump you have in place, the load curve of perhaps a solar installation that you have. The problem here is it's the OEMs who own that data, and they will never let you into their firmware, right? And again, by these load curves, you can't design any energy measures. It's like a partial snippet of what's going on in your building, but it doesn't tell you where the energy is going and why there's energy losses. So that's the second type of data, also pretty dumb. The third type of data is what a good energy retrofit startup does. It's called the physical substance, and nobody has that data except them. So you need to go actually and look at the actual installation of a building. You look at the thickness of the wall. You look at the windows, how many panes the windows have, how old the windows are, what is the roofing situation, what is the foundation situation, where is insulation in place, and then you run very normed calculations based on ISO norms that give you 40, 50 pages of calculations, which then gives you the physical substance. And the physical substance is the key to making very effective energy retrofit decisions. They allow you to create what I call the merit order of energy renovations, that only those who actually own the physical substance of a specific building will be able to do that. And that's what great energy retrofit and energy audit software companies, especially Enter, are doing. And that's a very important thesis here, is to go after the physical substance.
So basically, we're figuring out what's the current like U-values of the building or where the cold bridgings are. And then we're trying to apply as much insulation to the walls or roof or maybe to the slab. And then by that, we're making the building more thermally efficient.
Exactly. Okay. And so here's what's interesting about that, Martin, right? So any installer company that installs PV or that installs heat pumps or traditional boilers, they will never do that for you. Why? Yes. Because they always have an incentive to push the one product that they optimize for and that they have workforce for. So if you go to a PV startup, guess what? The PV startup will try to push a PV, but it might be more economically efficient for you to put an insulation first. So only an independent company that actually helps you with technology to get the physical substance of your building is able to make this credible arbitration.
Mm. Okay. So we spoke with Greg from AO on Tuesday, and he kind of classified the retrofit, the opportunity into three or four buckets. So platformization, wow. It must be another VC word that I haven't heard of before. So it's like a one-stop shop for customers here. New technologies themselves, so actually like the technology going into the heat pumps, the PV, maybe even the like material insulation itself, that kind of thing. And the labor upskilling, so enabling the lower skilled labor to be able to actually retrofit and install. I mean, there was a key emphasis he was saying that the supply side is very fragmented.
So my thoughts on this is you've got creating a platform, new technologies like tangible heat pumps, new insulations, labor upskilling. So all of this is so time consuming. It just takes years or decades, right, to get the new technology out, to teach the labor to do some installations, complex installation. So the platformization, how you call it, seems like it's software, right? And connecting the dots seems like the way to go and the way to start to collect all of these dots of the heat pumps or materials and then the labor or teams which are skilled enough to do the work, right?
So to the labor bottleneck, one of the unspoken truths or I think perhaps undercover truths is that 20 to 30% of the labor supply that we have in installation actually is wasted on admin work, writing quotes. That typically you have to write as an independent installer company that doesn't have any sort of proprietary channel. They write four times as many quotes as they convert into offers, which means if you eliminate that,
yes,
you actually can already eliminate a lot of admin. So that's one. Two, you can eliminate a lot of admin if you allow them to write a quote much faster, because the data acquisition of the information that you need in order to write the perfect quote and design the right specification for the building, what to do, if you already provide that and don't make the installer acquire that information, you can condense that admin work further. So all of a sudden, just by doing these two things, you will free up a lot of installer capacity in Europe and in the US that currently is bound by needless admin work. So that's where the one-stop shops for energy retrofit, market leader being Enter, come in, because they, by acquiring the physical substance, are a channel that has pre-qualified, pre-curated, and pre-specified what needs to be done. So the installers on the marketplace of Enter, being a one-stop shop, they love being there because they get a constant revenue stream. They can utilize their entire capacity without ever having to do any of this admin work. And so all of a sudden, they do 20 to 30% more capacity.
Yeah. On this point, from like enterprise point of view, from the platform point of view, I would say that at least in the UK, I don't know about Germany that much, but in the UK, you've got like certain types of houses that were built within certain eras, right? Mm. So on the same street, you can have like 200 houses, which were built between 1920 and 1925. All of them are exactly the same. All of their wall properties are the same. There's the same thickness, the same type of roof. So I think you can be tempted to think that if you have a data from one house on this street, and you can validate it by some sort of Google images that all of the rest is the same, that's mm-hmm. probably a good enough information to make a decision, make a judgment that all of these houses have the same, how do you call it, base properties, or you call
it, like, the word for it?
Yeah, they have the same, like, U values or the energy performance, right? So, so this is also kind of interesting in terms of data gathering. That
I think you're bang on with that, Martin. But there's another problem that only a one-stop shop in the end can really solve for you. So we have these, like, I don't know what to call it, like era-built settlements in other parts of Europe as well, right? So where one specific settlement was built in a decade, and they all have like the same properties, like you described. We have that all over Europe, and in the US as well, right? I mean, the US are masters at building like settlements with the same properties. But you need to self-identify the demand, because these settlements, if they're owned by different building owners, it doesn't help you if you just know that theoretically it would make sense to upgrade these. If every building owner makes a different purchase decision at a different point in time, you will be very inefficient in your distribution, because you can't access that demand. So what you want through these energy retrofit one-stop shops is to get to what we call self-identified demand, meaning the demand comes to you. And because they have done the energy audit, because they have triggered the energy audit, they have self-identified to have a purchase readiness, right? And so that's why working through the one-stop platform of an enter, you already can access the self-identified demand, rather than banging down doors and hoping that someone would open the door in that settlement and tell you, oh, maybe I could buy something, but why don't you do it on my neighbor first and I'll come back in 10 years, right? So that's like a shit distribution. But if you go through the one-stop shops, that's how you can access the demand very efficiently.
Yeah. So Enter, based in Germany, Berlin, near you guys over there somewhere in Europe. So this is an example of a platform company. Like in the simplest form, their model works by undertaking an energy analysis of your property. They send out and retrieve free quotes from their supply chain, and then match you with a contractor, and also help you match up with subsidies that perhaps the government or other incentives provide. So yeah, what excites you, Patrick, about Enter? And we should say that obviously they are a portfolio company of yours, but you still had to put some skin in the game here, and you obviously invested in them. So yeah, something must be tick the boxes for you.
Yeah, so I mean, we've described the model at length, so let me not reiterate everything that we've just discussed. So I think just summarizing it, the thesis makes sense, because you can access the physical substance that no one else does, and you can be a credible arbitrator of all the measures in the right order, and then you can help with the financing as well as the access to the supply side, and you can give the supply side an unrivaled, efficient access to the demand through distribution share. So that's been like the product thesis check. When we first invested, let me move to point two. When we first invested, it was 4 weeks after the start of the Ukraine war, which is a great point in time back then for the company to come out to fundraise. This was April 2020. And so at the time, the company was already net profitable. So the company had more or less bootstrapped with very, very, like we're talking $100,000 of family and friends money that they had used to become net profitable. They had built a great product. They had built a great reputation with customers. So we led the original pre-seed round in April 2020. 6 months later, they raised a seed round from two very good investors, Target Global and Partech. And only 4 months later, they then raised a 12 million Series A, co-led by us and Coatue in the US. So that was obviously like a big deal, because a reputed investor like Coatue, they do very few investments in Europe. They do very few investments at Series A. They do very few investments in climate. So all of that was a huge validation that Enter was building something pretty significant. And all of that happened in the span, like three rounds in the span of 10 months. And so we just closed the Series B, which we haven't announced yet. Very big round, very substantial for the company to keep accelerating. So that's like the second piece. And perhaps the third piece is it's an unbelievably great team. So the founder team and the executive team consists of four people. Two of them are architects who know everything about how to design a fantastic product and engineering experience around the energy audits. One of them is a former executive from the leading real estate software company in Germany called McMakler. And the fourth one is Matthias Lauck, the CTO of the company, who co-founded Lieferando, sold it to Takeaway.com, became Takeaway CTO, stayed for the IPO of Takeaway, then co-founded Tier, a mobility unicorn in Germany, and then decided to join Enter. So the team is is like very heavyweight, very legit. And so the economics of the company and this model make a ton of sense. We've already mentioned that they had been net profitable already. Terrific gross margins, very good contribution margins, great cash flow. So it's just a business that makes sense and that has a lot of scale. And then final point I'll say to this, the energy audit is the right to play in this market, because you acquire the physical substance and you gain the trust of the customer because you're a credible arbitrator. You have no adverse incentives of putting your workforce from the PV side or the heat pump side to work, because you don't have any of those. You're an independent party. But from there, because you've gained that trust, you can then arbitrate with which installers to work. So that's the installation marketplace that Entra has built. You can arbitrate the best financing options, which they have built. You can arbitrate the access to the subsidies, which they have built. And so there's other aspects around the home that a homeowner needs to procure over time, be it insurance, be it mortgage, be it utility tariffs. So because you have the trust of the building owner, you can arbitrate all of those, which is, you know, gives access to a vast market potential, both in B2C as well as in B2B landlords, which Entra covers.
A few points to uncover this. So what I like,
mine, don't we are like we're slim on time. So
slim on time.
Oh, yes. I talk too much.
So maybe just two instead of four.
Yeah.
So what I like in general about this like retrofitting space is that there's the demand is kind of time constrained, so that we have, let's say, 2,000 that all of those or most of those houses will have to be retrofitted, right? So it will be pushed, right? So for similar businesses to flourish. So another point is, so after more general, actually, maybe not necessarily, you don't have to reference to Enter, but after investment, a company like Enter, for example, when they have very good gross margin, so the investment goes into, I guess, the growth of the company, right? Like marketing, sales, etc., because the product is already done, it's working very well. Is the gross margin retained usually after the period of the investment, or is it diluted because of the expansion? A very, very general question.
It's a smart question. So let me not answer with regard to Enter, because it's actually not specific to Enter. It's a general wisdom that you can apply to almost any venture. So the in venture, whenever you raise a round, and the larger the round, the more true this is, your metrics will dip right after the round. Why? Because you use the capital in order to make certain investments into manpower, into marketing, etc. And investments never pay off overnight. It's just a universal physical truth, if you want. So making investments right after a round will make your metrics dip. And so it's what I call the dolphin theory, is the dolphin goes underwater for a time. And then in the end, the dolphin comes up for air again, if you make very good investments. So actually judging a startup metric 6-9 months right after a financing round, it's a poor look. You can basically put this in the bin and, you know, spend your time elsewhere, because it's not going to tell you much. But it's like a year after the funding round happened, when the dolphin should be back up for air, when you should make this judgment.
Okay. Mine, one more on this. And I'll just say this, we're cutting the intersection short, but watch this space, because I feel like we may have some exciting content coming out regarding Enter in the next few months. All right, that's it. You got one more question, Martin.
Yeah, we definitely entered the space. Let me say that. So after Enter Connect, for example, after Enter connects the dots, so basically they connect the supplier, the homeowner, and technology perhaps as well. What happens then? Isn't they? I don't know. They take commission or whatever, and do they have like some kind of subscription model, or do they retain this customer for a kind of lifetime of them living in this home, or how does it work?
You're thinking like an investor, Martin. I don't know what you drank this morning, but you have some bang on questions.
Patrick, it's the investor Kool-Aid you sent us by post a few weeks ago. Remember it?
I mean, I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad to hear it. No, but seriously, these are fantastic questions. So recurringness in this business, you need to build carefully, because once you start with recurringness, you can also harm the trust and that you gained with the building owner, because you might have gained or create the appearance of squeezing the lemon a little bit too much. So the way you expand customer lifetime value, CLTV, is by facilitating more and more transactions and thus building on the CLTV of the customer that you once acquired. So you start with the energy audit, then you facilitate the marketplace transactions, but in the right order, because, you know, they are unbiased. Then you facilitate the financing, you facilitate the subsidy. So all these stack up in expanding the CLTV to the benefit of the customer. And then later, once you, and that's my firm thesis, once you have gained all this trust, you can facilitate utility tariffs, you can facilitate mortgages. And that's where recurringness then comes into play.
Very nice. Okay, let's move on to the PR investment round. So I think it's important to cover this topic. And me and Martin debated it a little bit the other day. Patrick is the instigator of this topic. Yeah. So it got my cogs in my brain ticking. So I had a really good chat, and I'm very grateful for Kevin Ferguson for the chat we had and some notes that he sent over to me regarding this topic in particular. So Kevin runs AECO Marketing, which is a product marketing consultancy for construction tech startups. So, his notes was PR investment rounds are good. Few things. So obviously signals momentum to the market. You can see that the startup is growing, more customers, more revenue, and that can be attracted to investors. It's good for hires, job security, stability for customers, and awareness. So apparently new space in the world, in the tech world is scarce. So it's a great way, if you're raising a round, to get your name out there and raise some brand awareness. If you are looking specifically in the AEC industry, there's some typical news outlets. So the outlets that you're looking at, and some specific ones. So if you're looking on the national scale, would be TechCrunch, Forbes, Business Insiders. These are the kind of household names. But then you can go more specific into construction and VC. So construction, he sort of mentions Engineering News Record and Construction UK Magazine as examples. And then you can look at like Wall Street Journal and Fortune Turnsheet from the VC side. His advice, go to companies like TechCrunch, because when you break, if you're doing like a early stage series A or B, then if you give the exclusive to companies like TechCrunch, they will often distribute that content to their media list. So you'll get a broader reach. So yeah, some takeaways, but there are some things on the adverse side as well. But Patrick, I think it would be interesting to hear your opinion on PR for startup rounds, funding rounds.
Before Patrick, you go with it. So Owen, what is your position? Do you think it's positive or negative? Because after Patrick says something, you will change your mind. So I want to know. Is it positive or negative? You were negative a few days ago. Now you're kind of semi-positive on my side.
Well, you can't ask me that question just off the back of revealing lots of positive stuff, because my mind is now biased towards positivity. So maybe
you should not be biased. You should not be biased by positive reading. You should be quite still and cold about it.
Give me anyway. A minute. Let Patrick answer.
Okay.
This is quite fun. So we should really start a drinking game with our audience here. We need to cram in as many times the word nuance into an episode. Woo-hoo. Every time we say nuance, you need to take one.
Yeah.
So the answer requires nuance. So here's what I think with regard to PR. So there's with my portfolio firms, it's not a default that we do PR. In fact, I would say in our portfolio, we've actually run an analysis. So quick detour, and then I come back to Mark. We've actually run an analysis last year when we analyzed the success of media pundits, VCs, in predicting the eventual winners in ConstruTech by publishing market maps and best of lists. I'm sure you all have seen like these best of lists, like must be once a week. And the success was atrociously bad of these people. Why?
Yes.
Because they pick on the back of how big was the fundraising of a round, how much money went into a company, but they never talk to a company and actually analyze it on substance, which means that fundraising can compound PR, can compound fundraising, and all of a sudden a company goes bad. Look it up. I've published that analysis last year. You'll be surprised at the results. Which mean, and sorry, as part of that analysis, we actually found out that our five best performing companies financially for us have never been on a best of list. Let that sink in. So now back to the point. So I think the nuance required that I work with my portfolio founders on when it comes to PR is twofold. One, you need to get very strong curation. If you don't get strong curation and it's just another, let's say, media source, it's oftentimes not worth it. And two, you need to know who your audience is. So on the curation piece, if you publish a PR yourself and you put it on PRWeb, it's oftentimes not the strongest signal. And a nuanced investor, an investor that knows what they're doing, will actually know what to read into that nobody really picked up your story, etc. So they are like these signals these hidden signals that you should consider who is actually curating you. Another one, if you're in TechCrunch and you're publishing your news in TechCrunch, and it's more or less just a short news bit, it's a less strong curation as if you have a TechCrunch journalist actually spend several hours with you and create a real story about the company, pitch the product of the company, talk about the origins of the company. So just being in TechCrunch, I think is not nuanced enough. Take one. You have to really consider how strong is the curation. So that's one. Think about the curation element of it. And two, on the audience, I'll give you now an example that I learned. There are reasons and instances where startups in construction should not appear as a startup. They should actually appear as a serious business that has been around for many years. And publishing in tech media can harm that image. I have a fantastic marketplace in my portfolio. We have never published it. It's even after 3 years still in stealth mode. It's sort of an infra market for Europe. Very successful, but they figured out that their general contractor customers would not work with them if they perceived them as a tech company. They would only work with them if they perceived them as an established business with strong context, strong balance sheet, etc. So they made the conscious decision to never do PR. And it's one of the reasons why the company has grown insanely well with great margins. So be sure you know who your audience is. In that company, the audience was the general contractors and every other audience would have heard them. Whereas if you're a robotics company and right now your bottleneck is not acquiring projects, but your bottleneck is acquiring the very, very best software engineers, then you should by all means make sure that you do a ton of PR and tech media talking to that audience, right? So that's the second point. One is curation, the other one is audience. And I think most media people and most VCs who publish best of lists and market maps are absolutely atrociously shit at pushing the wrong companies.
Can I just correct mine before you speak? I just want to sort of like mention one thing. So, and just maybe a slight correction on what I said from Kevin. So his sole advice was not to like just go to TechCrunch, but specifically for AEC, his notes were look at the smaller companies that are closer to your customers. So this could be like small newsletters, podcasts, Bricks and Bytes, maybe influencers and smaller publications. So the premise is know who you're hiring when you do these things. Like PR can be expensive, figures I've heard are like upwards of $20,000 per month to do these kind of things. And you just end up going to the wrong people, getting the wrong market. So key takeaway is go to where your audience is.
Yeah, it's a good piece of advice. Yeah, I love these all of those lists, 30 under 30 in South London, Carshalton beaches, something
just
like that.
Just because you never won one, Martin, don't be bitter.
And so there's a very interesting article I read a few months ago, and I just pull it out now. So 30 under 30 year sentences. Why so many on Forbes Young Heroes face jail? So the recent example, Sam Bankman-Fried, who was jailed for 25 years on the FTX kind of fraud. So there is definitely
a correlation.
We're laughing about this, but there is actually a key point in this as well that I made in my post-mortem analysis of Media Pundits last year, Martin, that you're pointing out. The company you keep. If someone puts you on a best of list as a startup or as an individual, you actually usually don't know what company you're being put in, but the VCs, the investors will know because they talk to all the other companies. And if you're in company with five other founders who are like, you know, have a dubious reputation, it doesn't help your reputation being on that list either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a
mind. You can say the last thing and then can you close it off because we're getting too excited now.
Oh, I think you just have to close it off because it just opens the whole Pandora box.
Sounds like a topic for a future episode maybe.
Yeah.
Okay, look, yeah. If you want to say one thing, Martin, go for it. I'm not going to do the meditation.
No, I think I'm good. And then this will dive deep into this, which I would love to.
But
yeah.
Okay, on that note, thank you. To be continued. Thank you, Patrick. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.